your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math. What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where there is really no excuse for our reading assignment this time. I'm John McCoy, and with me is our old friend, Jason Snell.
I'm back with more old science fiction that was assigned in class.
And I still maintain, I cannot believe that anyone read this for high school, but Jason, you claim this.
This was, in fact, actually sophomore lit for me. I read this in the second semester of my sophomore year in high school. Absolutely.
Right. Well, Syracuse has also told me that he was assigned this. So
yeah. Hippie teachers in the 80s, I guess. I don't know.
Listen, I find this incredibly fascinating because I famously to me, I went to a school that my poor English teacher was taken to task by the local PTA for teaching Chaucer to high school students. They objected to the Miller's Tale.
I grew up in a small town, and my guess, and not a particularly liberal part of California. I grew up in the foothills in California, so a rural, fairly conservative area. My guess, this was a very young English teacher. He was probably no more than 23 or 24. In fact, I think back to it now, and I think, God, he must have been so young. And it was his first or second year teaching there, and I'm pretty sure he didn't last that long. I think he's in that kind of young, enthusiastic teachers who burn out very quickly and leave to do other things. And so I think maybe it just never got to the point where anybody, I don't recall any sort of challenges to content in these things, because maybe although it was conservative, it wasn't as religious, maybe. And a lot of the complaints about literature come from religious perspectives, but I don't know. I think maybe people just weren't paying attention.
In case you're all confused, although I don't know why you would be, because it's right there on the title of the podcast.
Yeah.
This time we are discussing Robert Heinlein's seminal novel, Stranger in a Strange Land, from 1960. Although he wrote this book on and off, I gather, since its conception in like 1948, it does seem to shift a lot in tone as it goes along. And that's one of the things that you either love or hate about this book. I did not read this for an assignment in high school. However, I did read this book in high school. When I was a kid, I've mentioned this before, I had this idea that I should like science fiction more than I did as a kid. And back in the 70s, science fiction was not as mainstream as it is today. And kind of what you had was you went to your local library and you had a few compilation books like the Hugo winners, or the Science Fiction Hall of Fame paperbacks or things like that, and you kind of read through these ratty, it kind of looked a little bit like pornography. It was like, you know, these ratty old paperbacks that were at that time, you know, had covers from the 60s, which were very lurid.
Yeah, the cheap pulp stuff. And my library was similar. Maybe you had some, like, Asimov, and some, maybe you had the Heinlein juveniles from the, you know, from the 50s. Maybe those were in there too. But, you know, you were lucky if you had Ursula Le Guin or
Arthur
C. Clarke or something like that.
Well, yeah, at this time, like, Anne McCaffrey was new. And that was exciting because those had big full color covers on them. I tried dutifully to read all the stuff. I remember reading Heinlein. I remember trying to make my way through the Foundation trilogy, which I never ever made very far into. So I'm not a good science fiction reader, and I apologize to our audience out there, because I'm going to come to this from the standpoint of an interested outsider. And my knowledge of science fiction history is sort of what I can glean from Wikipedia in the preparation for this podcast. So, Jason, I expect you to jump in and correct me on any of the things I get wrong.
Sure. I will say that old science fiction and kind of modern science fiction, ironically, I would say, are quite different. That it was a fairly conservative field for a long time. And so I read some, I actually just did for an episode of The Incomparable for my podcast, we reread the Foundation trilogy by Isaac Asimov. And it's got some good things in it, but boy, doesn't it not read like anything that would ever be published. I mean, in general, but certainly in the science fiction field today, just the way, the styles of that. And I found myself thinking about that a little bit while reading Stranger in a Strange Land, too. It's old science fiction and views, you know, because then you have to own up to the fact that science fiction really isn't about the future a lot of the time. It is a lens through which you view your present. And Heinlein has some specific issues he wants to talk about. And, you know, and then there's fax machines. There's a lot of fax machines in this book.
I do want to give a little bit of background for Heinlein, because it will come as no surprise to anyone that I had difficulties with this book. But one thing that I found was when I read about Heinlein's personal life and his history, it actually warmed me a lot more to the book than I had at first. And this is normally the reverse of what happens when I read about an author's biography. Normally, I read an author's biography and it makes me irritated with them, and I tend to like the art less. He was born in 1907, and his family is German-American. Apparently, there's a legend in his family that every generation had fought in an American war going back to the Revolution. So that his first, the first German ancestors to come over were among the Germans who fought in the American Revolutionary War. Now, I always thought that the Germans were hired by
I hope they weren't the Hessian mercenaries who were hired by the British, right?
That's what I thought they were, so I don't know.
They didn't try that hard, and then they stayed after they were...
Right. Well, I don't know which side he fought, the family fought on, but he himself went to Annapolis and graduated in 39, I believe. Or maybe that was... No, not 39. It was in...
Oh, 29.
29, right, 29. Here, yeah. And he was in the Navy through 34 when he had to be discharged for, what was it? It was like pulmonary disease of some sort. And I think this background of the military informs almost everything he wrote. He was very committed to the idea that individuals owed service to society. And this is an interesting thing about Heinlein, because he also, as you will see shortly as we discuss the book, was a fiercely independent libertarian. Mm-hmm. And in the current day, libertarianism tends to be about the belief that the government should have nothing to do with economic systems. In Heinlein's day, that meant more social libertarianism, and he was just a crazy guy. He was a nudist. He was he and his third wife apparently made their own crazy home in California, which was
near Santa Cruz. Yeah,
yeah, and it was featured in all these magazines for having all these fantastic devices in it. It was going to be the home of the future. So he was kind of playing Jetsons within his own life. He did turn to writing after he left the Navy. His first novel was published in 1947. His early novels are called his juveniles because they were written for a young audience. And they were... a lot of those books are still a lot of fun to read today. Between Planets, Tunnel in the Sky. And he wrote a ton of short stories. And he was one of that generation of writers who wrote for Astounding Science Fiction magazine.
This is all kind of new to me. I know that when he wrote Starship Troopers, it was kind of a demarcation point, because it was, I think his publisher dropped him because they felt that it was not an appropriate work for a younger audience, but it was thematically in keeping with that same sort of, like, you know, space adventure stories that he had been writing up to that point.
Right. Have you read Starship Troopers?
If I have no recollection of it. It's possible that I read it when I was a kid, and the movie has washed over my memory of it, but I have no clear memory of reading it.
Right. Now, Starship Troopers, I did try to read because I liked the setup, the technological realities of trying to launch a ground assault on a hostile alien world. And he had all these crazy ideas about people being dropped from spaceships in their suits that would burn up on entry and create all this flak so that they could defeat anti-aircraft, and then what happened when you hit the ground and how you fought these, and it was full of invention and excitement. And then almost immediately it fell over to people making long-winded philosophical speeches about what the individual owed to the government. And it was apparently Heinlein's answer to some calls for demilitarization after World War II. But also Heinlein had this idea that because of nuclear weapons, the world would have no choice but to switch to a world government. And that's
featured in Stranger in a Strange Land.
As featured in Stranger in a Strange Land. So he's a kind of a weirdo. You know, there's all these weird ideas percolating around in this book, as we'll get into it. Heinlein went on to become a mentor to a lot of other writers. And apparently he and his third wife, Virginia, who was also a crazy, accomplished naval lieutenant who was a chemical engineer, went around the world doing all kinds of charitable work and also setting up blood drives. And okay, do you want to jump in before we get into the discussion?
No, let's do it.
Okay, now this this book is about 500 pages long. Mm-hmm. And it feels like 1,200 pages. And so I'm going to try and, as loosely as possible, go through the plot, because there's a lot of plot.
It has movements, basically. It's so long that it's like there's whole sections that are like, oh, I actually got to one point where I was like, oh, this is the part I remember. But it had already been so many things that happened in the plot that it's big, and there's a lot of stuff packed into it.
But the other thing to note about it is stylistically, Heinlein does this thing where he will momentarily have the omnipotent voice of God explain what's happening on Earth and Mars and everywhere. And he'll push the plot along several months or maybe 20 years at a time. And then once we arrive in the next scene, you have to brace yourself because the next 50 pages are going to be somebody expounding at length why Rodin was the greatest sculpture the world has ever known.
Accurate. Accurate. It is neck snappingly fast how you will go from a chapter open where it's sort of and from a remove, the people of Mars look down on the Earth and all of that, and then you're in somebody's living room, and there's 10 pages where they're just talking about how they feel about politics. It's like, what? It just, snap, there you are.
Right. Okay. So this story starts with the first colonization attempt of sending humans to Mars. And we're told that because it takes so long to get to Mars, they chose to send 3 married couples. Because the idea would be that they would be the only people who could kind of get along and not kill each other over the course of whatever it was going to take, like 12 years to get there and back. And so there's a lot of kind of inventive discussion of what that means and finding these couples who can fulfill all the roles that they need in a space exploration.
Right. It's funny. I just went to a presentation by a guy who does some work for NASA and is on Mars exploration, on like what habitat and how you build a spacesuit for Mars. And he listed the crew, and he and I had just been reading this book, and he said one of the things they talk about on a 3-year mission to Mars is, do you have all men, all women? Do you have a mixed crew? Do you have married couples? And then he started to detail all that they have to be cross trainers, because they have to have skills in all of these different areas for this long mission, and you have to have backups in case somebody gets, and he was going through this, and I'm sitting there going, All right, Robert Heinlein, I'm going to give you full credit. 55 years ago, you published a book that is detailing exactly what people at NASA are still thinking about in terms of long-duration spaceflight. I was kind of impressed by that. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, this book's not really about this. But I was impressed that, I mean, that's all perfectly reasonable extrapolation of, like, how do you send a mission to Mars? And in this case, I think maybe the guy cheats by figuring out that if he flies to Australia and marries this lady, that they will then be qualified to go to Mars. But it apparently works and they go to Mars.
It's a very brisk moving, very humorous chapter. And it ends with the mission being lost. We're told that there are two transmissions that say, first is that they've arrived. The second is that Mars is inhabited. And then it goes blank.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a great, wonderful opening. And if the book had kind of continued along this way, I would be right on board with it. I'd say this to the book. The book has a lot of marvelously inventive segments, and those segments are quite delightful.
Today, this would be a 10-book series that would be doled out, a book a year. I think today an editor would look at this and say, Bob, great ideas. Why don't you just focus on the failed mission and the people who follow up for this book?
Right.
But this book's ambition is kind of boundless, which is why it is so huge and has so many different things, is that, and to its credit, I would say, yeah, every 40-page chunk of this has enough ideas in it that it could probably be a book on its own. And instead, it's just kind of all jammed together and on to the next idea.
We're told after this mission is lost in space that there is a world war on Earth, and that's all kind of glossed over in a very dry sort of way that we're not even going to get into this, what happens with the world war. And because of that, no one goes on any more missions to Mars for the next 20 years. And in the intervening time, a new space drive is discovered that allows them to make the trip in a few weeks or something like that to Mars.
Yeah, it's very short.
And so we pick up the news with humans coming back to Mars several decades later. And at that point, they find that, yes, in fact, everyone on this earlier mission did die, but that before they died, one of the couples that was on the mission had a child, who is called Valentine Michael Smith. And Mike, as the book calls him, was raised on Mars by Martians. We later learn that there was a love triangle involved and that the biological father of Mike was another one of the astronauts. And that was part of the reason why everyone died, was because there was a murder-suicide. And Michael was raised by Martians, and the Martians are only tangentially discussed. Mm-hmm. They almost never appear. What do we know about them?
Hundreds of pages in, he mentions, I think when looking at pictures of like cheesecake photos that one of the characters has, Mike thinks to himself, oh, they're all legs are pretty much the same. Now, humans only have two and Martians have three. And I went, Martians have three? Who could have fooled me? Because we don't really see that they're kind of not present. I think partly on purpose, they are distant and mysterious and ancient. And, we can't even understand them and they don't even really get described.
There's a lot of subversion of science fiction tropes. First of all, we have the heroic mission that fails utterly. Then we have the idea of going to Mars, and the Martian that we find there is a human, and he comes back and he's given the most blandly human name possible, Michael Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately the action follows him returning back to Earth, and we're left to kind of wonder about what's going on back on Mars and what these Martians are up to. And we're only going to learn about Mars and Martian culture through the experience and the mind of Mike,
mm-hmm.
who is brought back to Earth. And almost immediately locked away in a hospital. And we are introduced to two crazy characters named Ben. I don't know his last name.
Ben Caxton.
Ben Caxton, right, who is a newspaper reporter because...
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a columnist, although they call him... It's in debate whether he's a Winchell or a Lippman, apparently, for names of former, old school journalists. But regardless, he has a daily column in the newspaper or Telefax or whatever equivalent that they have in this world.
Right. Well, his reporter's instincts have been buzzing, and he has the idea that the world government wants to keep Mike out of the public eye and possibly lose him entirely for a lot of reasons. One being that Mike is the sole inheritor of an enormous fortune. Mm-hmm. Of all the people who went on this trip together have signed a document that leaves their fortunes collectively to any offspring, and he's the only offspring. And also because there is this strange legal precedent.
The premise of it, and it apparently happened on the moon first, is that if you land on a planet, you get the territory. You basically have claimed it for yourself.
Right.
And, they apparently in the intervening 25 years have learned to get all of their astronauts to sign some sort of non-disclosure agreement or something that gives the government all the rights, but that didn't happen in Mike's case. So he's technically he owns Mars,
right?
As far as they can tell,
right? It's called the Larkin decision.
That's it,
right? And the and he realizes that because of these weird legal precedences, the world government wants Mike not necessarily dead, but he want him out of the picture, and they're going to keep him locked up in this hospital forever. And so Ben has a gal on the inside, and I call her a gal because Jillian Boardman is her name, but they call her Jill throughout this novel.
Right.
And when Ben and Jill talk to each other, the dialogue is straight out of a 1940s screwball comedy. It's yep. all just wacky sexual banter back and forth, and just say,
"Don't worry about it, baby doll. It'll be fine. It'll be fine." Oh, gee, Ben, I don't know. I could lose my job over it. Don't worry about it, dearie. It is totally that kind of relationship.
We're told that Jill is a boy crazy nurse, and we're told that Ben is a hard nosed, hard drinking newspaper man.
She's also described as a spinster, isn't she?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is...
Let's
just get this on the table right now. Heinlein has odd ideas about women.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he has odd ideas about men. He has ideas about everyone. But his ideas about sex are really weird. And they just get weirder and weirder through this book. And one of the reasons I mentioned that it sounds like screwball comedy at this point is because, as kind of odd as it is for Ben and Jill to be flirting back and forth, that's a breath of fresh air compared to what happens later on in the mm-hmm. books. And I think that that's one of the ways in which this book reveals that it was written over a long period of time. I think that the beginning of this book really feels like, like an old 50s style novel, and mm-hmm. it grows into something completely different.
Yeah, I told my wife this book takes several left turns, hard left turns, as you're reading it, and you're like, whoa, okay, I guess that part's over now. And I think it being written in layers like that by him over time, and feeling like it wasn't ready to be published until he sort of picked his spots, and I think he picked a good one because it became a hit by waiting until a time when people were questioning a lot of things about assumptions of society and mores and things like that. But yeah, this here, she is, I don't know, she's got action, and yet she's driven by Ben. And I kept trying to think, like, is she our heroine or not? Because what she does, she's sort of put up to it by him. Obviously, it's a function of the time it was written, but I'm trying to pick apart whether she is meant to represent some, that she is a more liberated gal, or whether not.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to tell at this point. It does seem very much like a standard kind of dynamic of she's the young girl Friday, but she's got the more mature, responsible guy who's telling her what to do. And then, you know, in the big picture things. And then she, you know, kind of capably executes her orders, which that seems to be the relationship they have.
I don't know if I mentioned this yet, but Jill is a nurse at the hospital where Mike is being held, and she has access, but only limited access because they're kind of keeping him under lock and key. When it turns out that a fake man from Mars is brought out for a press conference, Ben suspects that they're going to take the real man from Mars and either just kill him and dump him somewhere, or they're going to take him off and put him into some asylum, some nice asylum somewhere where nobody will ever see him.
Right.
He figures that Jill and he have to spring him from the hospital, and they come up with this plan. How does she get him out eventually? She basically...
Well, first off, they fake it where there's like an old lady on the video monitor, but it's a fake, and that he's still in the room, even though they said they moved him. And she realizes her key card works, and that the security isn't that great. And a guy, like a doctor, needs to go check on something or go to the bathroom or something. And so he leaves, and she says, "Oh, I'll watch him." And that gives her access, and she ends up being able to kind of go in. And there are two doors, so she can go out the back door. She takes him to the, Does she bring in a nurse's outfit, or she maybe has him as a patient and takes him to the nurse's locker room? But in the end, she dresses him as a nurse, and his hair is long enough that it's in the shorter style that women might wear. And she takes him to the roof to get a flying car taxi. But she's basically, she's able with her access to get him out of the hospital, knowing that they're going to know it's her when she does this. But she decides to do it because she's sort of befriended him and he seems nice. And she has a, you know, I guess you might even say almost motherly kind of a thing, which is in fitting with the way that women are portrayed, especially early on in this book, which is they have, you know, motherly instinct is something that they're allowed to have.
One thing I'll say before we get into the carrying of the character of Mike here is one of the great pleasures of reading this book is, one of those great pleasures of reading any old science fiction, what passes for technology and what they think is what Heinlein thought was going to be the big thing or not. Because there's this one point where Ben hands her basically an earpiece that she can record conversations on, and a big deal is made out of this, like, oh, this is this exciting bug that you can put anywhere, and how great is that? And it reminded me actually of a similar device in Fahrenheit 451,
and it's got like tape or something in it where you have to like take a spool out of it and then put another spool into it every day or something like that,
right? Because everything is on tape. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have flying cars, and we also are told that Ben has an apartment that has live grass growing for its carpeting.
He's got like a rug that is actually just like live grass that grows in the middle of his... Yeah, it's funny. But then the thing about a lot of old science fiction is you notice when it's wrong. Like I said, there's a moment that I actually highlighted that made me laugh. That was we're about to get to the point where Ben disappears, right?
Right.
And there's this whole thing about him sending a message saying, I have to go on a story somewhere, but I'll be back in a week or something like that. I can complain about this plot line because I think it's really boring. But what I laughed about it is that the process by which he sent a text message to his office, an email basically, is he or somebody had to call someone, dictate a message. They used a typewriter to type it. Then they would photograph the piece of paper that had typewritten on it, and then they would essentially fax it to where it needed to go. And I just thought, it's so sweet. You've got flying cars, but you can't envision just sending the text onto a screen. It's like, no. It's much more complicated, involving typewriters and photographs.
Now, we should mention here that a little bit about Mike, because Mike, when he gets to Earth, we're told is unused to Earth's atmosphere or to Earth's gravity.
Yeah.
He has almost no muscle mass. And so he's very weak. But on top of that, he is catatonic most of the time because we're told that he can't process all of the information around him.
Right.
And also people are acting so very strangely to him by his Martian standards. He can't understand why people are so emotional. He can't understand why people keep asking questions that need to be answered right away. Early on, when Jill goes into his room, she offers him a drink of water, which is fortuitous because, as we learn in the book, sharing water is the way that Martians create close relationships, and they are called water brothers. And the fact that she does this early on imprints her on him. We don't know much about Martian culture at this point, but we are told that Earth culture is so confusing to Mike that he's actually in danger of just dying.
Yeah, I like about this is if you view this novel as a critique of our cultural preconceptions, that we assume things are the way they are because they are fundamentals. And what Heinlein is trying to do, I think, a lot of points in this book is say they aren't. There are no fundamentals. You can be anything and do anything. And there's some arguments against that, but even then they're made to service his purpose. Like there's a conversation about cannibalism that happens later where a guy says basically, you know, everybody knows cannibalism is wrong and you know it from when you're a child. And Jubal Harshaw, who we're about to meet, says, well, no, actually every human culture goes through at least a phase where cannibalism is common. So that's not true. You're wrong about it. But here, what it's trying to say basically is everything we know is a thing about how to be human is a learned behavior. That Valentine Michael Smith grew up on Mars, he never learned any of this behavior. So everything we do makes no sense to him. And based on the title of the book, you know, this is the point where you're like, oh, I see where this book is going to go. And it sort of goes there and it sort of doesn't, which is he is able to view our foibles and our assumptions and all of these other things with this unique perspective of being a human, but still an outsider. And all the ways that, you know, he has learned to process information that are not, that we assume are human nature, he proves are not. So I think it's interesting here, and he's got stuff, he can control his body, he can shut down his heart basically, but not die. Lots of interesting stuff that happens with him at this point, even though we don't know a lot about Martian society. And then yes, you're right, fortuitously, sharing water on the very dry planet of Mars is something that's akin to, like, it's almost as strong as a wedding vow kind of thing, although all adult Martians are male, I guess, so it's not quite like that, but it's like that. It makes Jill basically the only person on Earth that Mike can trust.
You do mention Jubal Harshaw. We are told by Ben that when they succeed in breaking Mike out of the hospital prison, they're going to make it to Jubal Harshaw's residence. And at this point, he's just talked about, we're told that he is an author, and also he is a lawyer, and also he is a doctor.
He's pretty amazing.
Right. He's basically sort of a Buckaroo Banzai character.
Oh, man.
But we don't know anything about him except that that's where they plan to go. But as you mentioned, right after Jill breaks Mike out, Ben goes missing.
Hmm.
And to make matters worse, Jill goes to Ben's apartment because she thinks that's the one place that they will be safe. And there are hired goons after them. These two hired goons show up and they want to bring Michael back, and they pull guns on Jill and Mike, and then they disappear.
Yeah, he reaches out for them and they disappear.
Right.
Which is it's a kind of a cool scene. I don't know. I wanted to mention, by the way, as a kid who grew up loving Star Trek, that there's a Star Trek episode called Charlie X that is essentially telling this exact same story. Like, exactly. And I looked it up, and it is something that's been well known for a long time. And I don't know if Gene Roddenberry and Robert Heinlein were drawing from the same background, because it's a little bit similar to that episode of The Twilight Zone with Anthony, who sends the people out into the cornfield. The idea of a childlike person who's got these kind of amazing powers to make people go away. But that's what happens in the Star Trek episode too, is he makes people go away. And I guess Captain Kirk is Jubal Harshaw in that. Anyway, it's funny. And there's also a character in the first or the second pilot of Star Trek who can control. He's so advanced, he gets zapped and becomes more advanced, and he can control his heart rate. And so there are a bunch of things while I was reading this. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, this all got pilfered by Star Trek. just a few years later, 4 or 5 years later. But that I was struck because it's a similar scene where there's kind of goons or people who are menacing someone, and you make them our hero, our innocent hero, thinks nothing of making them just go away because that's you know what would you do? But I thought that was a nice a shocker and kind of interesting in a part of the book that I a lot of this I found really boring because there's a lot of logistics here. This is one of those cases where as somebody who I'm not a fiction editor, I'm a nonfiction editor, but as an editor, I look at this and think, you know, do we need all the like details of the heist at the hospital and everything that Ben is doing in terms of setting up his plan? There's a lot of like step one, step two, step three stuff that happens in this section that seems to have very little import in what the book is about. And just, I, you know, given that that this book is not hurting for length, it feels like he didn't know where he was going with it. And so he wrote it. And then at no point did anybody say, let's just take a lot of this stuff out because it's too much.
I'll agree with you. There's way too much incident in this first bit, but that will be replaced shortly by people talking and talking.
That's true.
And talking. So
it's true. So be careful what you wish for.
Right. Now, this book, as you mentioned before, is broken up into sections. The first section was called His Immaculate Conception. And right now we're moving to part two, which is called His Preposterous Heritage, which is after Jill is able to arrive at Jubal Harshaw's house.
Jubal Harshaw, well, he, as you said, he is a Renaissance man. He is, what can't he do? He is a doctor. He is a lawyer. He has this lovely house with a swimming pool. In fact, if you had asked me what I remember about Stranger in a Strange Land, I would say there is a rich guy with a swimming pool and that Valentine Michael Smith sits down at the bottom of it for a while, which does happen. It absolutely does happen. And I just, I did that stuck with me, but he is fascinating. He has living with him in this house with it's in Pennsylvania. It's like in out in the country in Pennsylvania, up in the mountains. I don't know, but it's outside of New York. In the state of Pennsylvania, he's got like a mechanic guy and like an IT guy basically, and then he's got these four women, or are there three women? The three women to start, and then Jill basically is the fourth. He's got these three women, and it's the reason I could tell that it was three is because there's the one with the dark hair, the blonde, and the redhead. That's one of them is a little older, and one of them is a little younger, and one of them is in between, and that is essentially how they're described. And they are similar to Jubal. They are incredibly capable people, but they are also sort of his, you know, literally his life seems to be sitting out by the pool, watching the girls sunbathe or jump in the pool, and then he shouts front. And one of them will, whoever's on call essentially, will come over to him and take dictation. And he will just sort of like say crazy things and say, that's a short story, finish that up and mail it off. And this is how he lives his life. He's a kind of a hedonist, and he's an older fellow. I always pictured him almost as Sidney Greenstreet kind of guy. But then later on, he says that one of the girls weighs more than he does, so he must actually be an old skinny guy. He is quite a character because he does know everything, and he is living that kind of ultimate. He's got enough money and power that he is living the ultimate libertarian life. You know, this is your, I've got my compound. I can do what I want. I can live the way I want. People would frown on me having these three beautiful women who are my, you know, servants / you know, whatever. But I don't care. And we live our life the way we want. And when Jill shows up with Mike, his response is very much, well, I don't want to really get involved. Like, well, I'll help you because I'm honorable, but I don't want to really get involved in affairs in the world and stuff like that because I've got it pretty good here just doing what I do now. So he's a really interesting guy. He can do everything, you know, and again, the women are all incredibly capable too. So you don't get the sense like, what it must be like for them, their servants, because you get the sense that that's not really what this is, that whether they are in a kind of group relationship or whether they're just incredibly enlightened, cool people who are happy to live this lifestyle with their boss, but it is this kind of hippie hedonistic secretarial pool kind of thing that's happening, along with a literal pool. It's crazy.
I always pictured him as Hugh Hefner lounging in his bathrobe. And just like Hugh Hefner, he likes to think of himself as above the mores of society.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he also likes to see himself as being highly cultured. And he's going to hold forth his opinions on everyone. He's presented as sort of curmudgeonly. And the three secretaries, whose names are, by the way, Anne, Miriam, and Dorcas,
mm-hmm.
we're told that Jubal is celibate.
Yeah, he's disinterested in sex, apparently.
But he's still going to constantly be making sexual innuendo, and he's constantly going to be leering at the women who constantly playing in the pool. And as you say, the pool is, for the next 200 pages, the pool is like another character in this book.
There's an awful lot of swimming pool.
Right. The other thing that is hilarious about this is his primary income is from writing short stories. And we're told that he is known the world over for his stories, that mm-hmm. he is able to make a living at this. And
everybody he meets out in the world says, "Oh, Mr. Harsha, I love your stories."
Right.
Okay.
And it's ridiculous because Heinlein knows better. You know, he's an actual author and he knows what publishing is like. And instead, he writes a story about this crazy guy who writes half a story and then tells his secretary to finish the rest of it and put it in the mail and it will be published next week. You know,
and don't look at it. I never want to revise it. Right. He says at one point, there's no point. If I can't just do it off the top of my head, it's not worth doing. He says at some point.
And I'll say this for the book. There's a lot of points in this book where I am not sure how seriously Heinlein wants us to take any of this. Mm. You know, there's parts where he's just winking at us so hard that I don't know whether or not in the end he wants us to take any of this seriously. But on the other hand, Jubal Harsha will very soon start holding forth on issues of politics, on issues of sexuality, mm-hmm. on issues of aesthetics, and they're presented so bluntly and so earnestly, and the people he talks to are able to put up no cogent arguments against him, that you can't help but think that this is just Heinlein kind of unloading his theory of everything on us.
Yeah, it's and this again is one of those places where I feel like this could be a book unto itself. It's like Jubal Harsha is the character in this, not really Mike, that all this time later stuck with me, because he is this outsized character. And it is true, he ends up being like a megaphone used by the author to espouse at least some values, whether they're the author's or not. I think that it's certainly bringing up issues that the author feels are important to challenge people about, which, you know, again, you can go down a path of like, is cannibalism okay or not without actually advocating for cannibalism just as an exercise. But there's an awful lot of that sort of thing here too. So Jubal, I don't know, is it a satire? This is a future world, so perhaps he's suggesting that things are so devolved that this is what passes for writing in the society. It may just be that he is trying to write something that's heightened. So, you know, Jubal and his lifestyle are heightened. The religion, the dominant religion in the United States at this time, which we haven't even really discovered at this point in the book, this Fosterism, is also kind of ridiculous and heightened. And so, you know, yeah, it's all kind of outsized, and I don't think he really intends for us to take it seriously. This is a future-ish world where everything is kind of bigger, and I think he must be thinking, better to tell you my ideas in the sort of ridiculous context here, because maybe they'll, you know, maybe you'll see what I'm trying to say about the human condition. Something like that is probably going on here. But I do love the, you know, Jubal and the swimming pool and the little kind of commune that he's got, and the plot idea that this woman shows up at his door. It's almost noirish, shows up at his door with a, not a dead body, but basically a dead body in the back seat of the car, and brings the world into this guy's sort of perfect life that he set up for himself, and messes it up, at least in the short term.
For the next section of the book, we have Mike slowly becoming more healthier, mm-hmm. and we're told that he's able to manipulate his own metabolism and his own tissue growth just by thinking about it.
Yeah.
Jubal, in the meantime, is trying desperately to figure out what the legal angle he is going to use to defend Mike against the goons that keep coming.
From the world government, basically.
Right, from the world government. Well, he identifies that it's probably not coming from the top. It's probably coming from sort of middle management of the world government.
There's a nice, you know, but again, very long aside about how it's never, and this is true, and this is before Watergate, you know, a full decade plus, but saying that, you know, it's never the guy at the top who knows the details of, like, who sends the order for you to kill a guy. It's like a lieutenant, and they keep it from the guy on the top, so the guy on the top wouldn't approve it, and if he knew, he would disapprove it, so they don't tell him. And they do what they feel needs to be done. And I thought that was a, it went on a long time, but I thought that was an interesting, again, an interesting little essay through this character about how power works and how the most powerful people are often insulated from the kind of worst offenses. It's like, you know, I liked that. That stuck with me as an interesting little aside. Of course, the way it's done is that it's just a speech where Jubal educates somebody about why this is going to happen for five pages.
And one of Jubal's secretaries is what's called a fair witness, which is one of these weird ideas that Heinlein has that makes little to no sense, really, but it's kind of an interesting idea.
She's like a super notary, I guess.
Right. The idea is that when you wear these robes of a fair witness, you become a disinterested super observer who's able to completely recall everything that you see later without any opinion whatsoever. And it's never quite explained whether that's because these people have some sort of heightened psychic powers or whether there's some pharmaceuticals involved or whether...
Yeah, she says she has perfect recall. So whether that is from some special thing or whether only people with perfect recall can become fair witnesses, it's unclear.
The weird thing about this is there's a lot of time spent explaining this and then it's like given... It almost doesn't feature in the plot at all.
We spend more time reading about her putting on and taking off her robe than her services as a fair witness.
We've got a lot more to go through, so let's push here. The police show up, or the world police, the goons, whether they're actual officers of the state or whether they're just hired goons, I don't know. They show up at Jubal's place. Michael has been told to hide
bottom of the swimming pool.
Exactly. At the bottom of
They've left it a little murky, so it's hard. They haven't cleaned the pool in a while. They go into some detail on that. Yeah. So he's down there in the bottom of the pool, not breathing, just sitting there. But he wants to see what's going on, so he detaches his like astral form from his body so that he can like see what's going on, even though he's down under the pool when the goons arrive.
As he floats freely around, he sees that these people are pointing guns, and we have established at this point that Michael has explained a little bit about this process to Jubal, that if he senses a wrongness in something, he can make it go away, and making it go away is pushing it into, I guess, another dimension.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cleverly described. It's like the object is seen as receding into the distance from all points, from all directions.
Right.
Which is impossible. So it's obviously there's underlying this is some understanding of some interesting things that he doesn't get into about like science, actual science, but that are there like this is it's getting pushed into another dimension. And the way he describes that is I thought kind of clever. So that's how and then they can't come back. They're not like in an ice box somewhere. They're just gone.
It's one of the ways in which Heinlein builds up what Martian's ethics are. You know, we're on the one hand, Mike seems like a baby or a naive lost in the woods. On the other hand, he's very dangerous. He can make you disappear and you will be gone. He doesn't think much about killing people because to him, death is not really that big a deal.
Right. It's just discorporation. Because in Martian society, when you die, it's sort of a choice that you make usually. And then your spirit leaves your body and then you're an old one and you hang around. So your ghosts, you know, it's a society run by ghosts essentially on Mars. So it's not a big deal if you die.
He does push several of these goons into this other dimension. And there's actually a very funny line where Jubal says, "We can't have any more of this whole scale disappearing of policemen." And he calls in some favors. He knows some people who put him in touch with the personal astrologer for the world government. And that's also fairly cognizant considering what we
Nancy
know
Reagan.
About. Exactly.
Yeah. There's a great line that I actually highlighted, which was, "Joseph, I told you repeatedly, the only true science is astrology." So again, satirizing this is a ridiculous society that he's depicting here. But yeah, Nancy Reagan consulted with an astrologer, so it's not that that was an accidentally brilliant. I believe when that came out that she was using an astrologer, people were pointing to Stranger in a Strange Land. Like immediately, they're like, oh, look at that.
Jubal arranges to have a meeting with Mike and the head of the world government, whose name is Douglas. We'll just call him Douglas.
Yeah.
And
Joe Douglas.
Right. And so there's a lot of scenes of them getting ready to go. There's a sequence where after they call off the attack on the compound, Mike kisses one of the secretaries. And it's just the most ridiculous bit of writing where, like, every one of the secretaries in turn wants to kiss Mike because he's such a stud.
He gives you his full attention. And he doesn't even say, like, he stretches time or anything like that. It's like, no, he's paying attention to me. That's the difference. And you guys can't measure up, which, okay, I guess. But it is, I do actually remember that from reading it before. And, and it's not great.
I mean, here's the thing. I will get more into this because this book gets only weirder sexually as it goes along. The thing about this book for me that I find a little bit unnerving is not the amount of sexual activity in this book or the proposition that as we get along the book starts to explore polyamory and free love and that sort of thing. That's fine. I think that there's cases that can be made for or against it, but there is an assumption in this book that I would call sort of the Playboy assumption, which is that women need to be sexually available at all times and that they will be happier if they are. Yes. And if they go along with that, it will be better for everybody.
There is a scene with Jill where they're in Las Vegas, much later in the book, and she's watching, she's sort of like telepathically bonded with Mike at this point, and she's watching some sort of burlesque show on stage. I don't know whether it's stripping or but it's something like that. And there's this whole thing that he goes into about how she feels, it's a long thing about how the male gaze and being a woman is to enjoy being looked at and appreciated by a man. That is the sort of like the thing that, so men appreciate women and women are appreciated by men. Those are the jobs, which is problematic. And then also, just as an aside, although this book talks about homosexuality, it really doesn't want to get into it. And maybe that's practicality reasons. Maybe that this is a line that he doesn't want to cross at this point in 1961. But there's even a moment where Jill is appreciating the burlesque dancers where she says basically, well, when Mike's attention moves elsewhere, then she's not interested in looking at the women anymore. And it actually says, like, fortunately, she's got too much going on to worry about being a lesbian. Actually, is in the book. I'm like, man, and there's a lot of like men with women and women with men, and hand waving about homosexuality in a way that I thought is like, I don't think you're being consistent here. Again, perhaps he just didn't want to go down that road. But for all of this kind of open and free love kind of thing, it is all about men having sex with women. Essentially, that's it, too. Not about women having sex with who they want to so much, either.
When it's Jubal talking about issues of politics or aesthetics, when it's Mike talking about his Martian views, I would characterize it as a sort of a pish and tush kind of approach to things. I've got it figured out, and you poor squares, you know, you don't know what it, you don't get it, but I'm too advanced to spend much time formulating an argument for you. And the book is just going to put this forward as though all of these things were self-evident, that it's self-evident that people need to be free to live the whatever life they want, and that it's self-evident that includes men having access to women at all times. That includes the fact that modern art is a crock, and that the only great art was by Rodin.
Rodin, yeah.
This is starting to fall apart here, and we haven't gotten halfway through this book.
I want to mention two more things about women, because again, this is maybe a thing about the period, but there are some shocking items in here. Like there is a scene where it's time for the men to gather and talk about what they're going to do, and it is, you know, these women did not chatter. They didn't intrude into the sober talk of men. They were quick with food and drink in warm hospitality, and then literally likens a woman to a cat,
right?
A liberty permitted cats and favorite children in the privacy of the home is something that you can also give to women. And then later there's a line that is, 9 times out of 10, if a girl gets raped, it's partly her fault.
Right.
I'm like, dang. Anyway, so it, you know, yeah, 1961, but this, for a book that is, I think once you kind of open it up and say, hey man, we're going to be cool and we're going to rethink values, you open yourself up to criticism when your values are really not as open as you think they are. And that, I got that. I appreciate that this was written 55, 60 years ago. Still, it is a male fantasy of female empowerment.
They do bring Mike to the world government, where they have a hearing with the head of the government and with several heads of individual countries, because although there is a world government, there are still countries out there, and they make a big deal out of the fact that they get Mike to appear and have a fake flag put up for Mars, and they play
long scene. I asked myself, do we really need to know? I mean, this is, again, from a different book. This is Jubal Harshaw's clever courtroom shenanigans to get exactly what he wants to have happen to the world government. But, do we need to see his, you know, they get there early, they turn down the president, they get them to do a flag, he plays the from the planet suite,
right.
They have them play the Mars theme as the made-up anthem of Mars. He's doing this for legal reasons, for made-up legal reasons, but it's all made-up, so I guess it doesn't matter. And then they go through all this to sort of like make it clear in public that he's being recognized and that Mike's okay. And then they repair back to a hotel and they have this whole conversation at the hotel. This was a scene where it really dragged for me, because I felt like nobody was actually in danger at this point, really. And it was like this courtroom drama about kind of made up things in this future government. And it was,
And it's still not clear to me what exactly it all accomplished. I mean, Jubal spends a lot of time patting himself on the back, saying, aha, we've tricked them into recognizing Mike as being the...
Because he makes the president of the world into his, like, personal guardian or something, and this is a coup.
Right. So, anyway, basically the upshot of this is there are no more armed goons coming after Mike. And when they go back to the mansion, Mike is got his inheritance. There's a long section where he buys presents for everyone, which is why we have discussion of Rodin, because it turns out that Jubal Harshaw is actually an old softie because he loves Rodin, And oh my God. So that goes on for another, I don't know, let's say 50 chapters. And they.
That's, yep.
And then we get to part three.
Also, we very rarely see Mike learn things. Occasionally, right. There's a scene where we see him learn something. There's a revelatory scene he has later where he starts to understand humanity by watching monkeys at the zoo, at the San Francisco Zoo.
Right.
But most of the time, we're just told, okay, Mike has done this now. Mike has figured this out now, either by the narrator or by a different character. And that's really frustrating. If you go to the show, don't tell kind of school of writing, really frustrating that this book that is supposedly about this outsider character trying to judge us and learn from us and understand how human society puts us in boxes, we spend an awful lot of time not with him when he's doing that.
Right. Well, this is not show, don't tell. This is... Don't tell. Tell for several more chapters than you think are necessary. And so, anyway, yep. This goes into the next section, part three, which is called His Eccentric Education. And this is where we get really deep into the religious part of the book.
Right.
And we are told more about Fosterites, which we have been introduced to. There's a shift in tone that takes place in this book. And it's a book, as we've mentioned, that's very, very long and was written, I guess, over 12 years. But there is a major shift in tone, I think, mm-hmm. at this point, where first of all, the character of Mike changes drastically.
Yeah.
And second of all, there are a lot of little weird writerly things where, like, it keeps shifting point of view, or it shifts between present tense and past tense for just kind of nutty reasons.
Yeah, suddenly, again, it's that snap your neck kind of thing of like, whoa, okay, that we're on to the next thing. Also, this is the wacky religious satire section of the book, which I don't know, maybe was more bold in the early 60s when this was published. Having grown up in the 80s and the era of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, I find it a little less outlandish than perhaps it was then, but it still is a very broad... The Church of Foster, I mean, it's like... I don't know. I mean, is it satirizing? It's sort of like, it reminds me of Mormonism in a little bit, in a way, but it's like the reverse Mormonism where all they do is drink right. and have sex in their secret circles, in their secret temples. But it's the whole thing... Obviously, this is a man who wants, Heinlein, who wants to lay it all out about his thoughts about religion and why people believe in religion and the foibles of modern religions and organized religions and what it's really all about. And fair enough, but there's an awful lot of it, and I'm not sure he pulls it off.
Well, it would be very contemporary for this to be written about, because... In the 1930s, I know there was a huge explosion in religious programming on the radio, and that was marked by a kind of a different tenor to it. That was when sort of modern-day evangelical approach started, was in the...
Yeah, essentially televangelism on the radio.
By the time this book was written, televangelism on the television was starting. So
starting.
It would be current, and... As you mentioned, the Fosterites, named for their founder, his name is Foster, are this kind of a crazy hedonistic. Their temple is this big sort of casino where people play slot machines all the time, and mm-hmm. if they win their blessings, they take their winnings, and they're encouraged to make a donation back to the church. So it's
it's broad satire on religion and religious giving and the fact that why don't we just turn it all into it? We'll put a casino in the church, and then we'll just have them give their winnings to the church. And there's a line about how if you want to cash out, if you're not a believer, that's okay. Non-believers are welcome. But if you cash out, they've got lots of opportunities to proselytize at you before you can get your money out.
Mike becomes sort of a celebrity after his appearance on television. We're told that he's getting all these love letters.
Yes. We have detailed descriptions of the various ways they sort mail at the compound.
Oh, God. Yes. We have a long description of how they sort through all his fan mail.
It's lettered. There's like A through G. And then later they refer to like some of those go in G. And I'm like, do I have to turn back to see what G was?
And, then we have a segment where Jill is incensed because someone has sent Mike a naked picture of themselves.
Yeah.
And we have a long discussion between her and Jubal about the politics of women sending naked pictures to each other and why it's okay. Oh my God. Yeah. But in any case, he does receive an invitation brought on behalf of a prominent senator who is a Fosterite.
Right.
And he wants to go because Mike is fascinated with religion. He doesn't understand human religion. He says right. that on Mars there's no religion because everyone is just told what is real or is not by the old ones, and there is no difference then between religion or science.
Right. When everybody dies and they stay around, you don't really need a religion, I think is the point, because they know what happens after you die, which is you're an old one and you hang around and run the planet.
Right. And when Mike wants to go see this place, we're told that Jubal is kind of worried about this because he thinks mm-hmm. that whatever else the Fosterites are, he thinks they're earnest, and he knows that Mike responds to earnestness. And yeah. so he's worried that Mike will be converted and then the church will have this coup of having the man from Mars on their side.
Or you could argue that he's also worried that it will give Mike ideas, which it does.
Right. So they go to this temple. They're introduced to this guy, Digby is his name, who right. is currently running the church after the death of Foster. And Foster himself, although he's dead, is still there.
Yeah, like Lenin-like. He's got his like dead body in a tomb in the place. And that upsets Mike because it's just rotten meat. He doesn't understand why.
Right.
It's a wrongness to
right.
him.
Right. As we mentioned before, the Martians are cannibals, partially because there's a lack of resources on Mars, so you don't want to waste any food lying around. But also, eating someone is considered a sign of respect to them. And it's
right.
the way...
It's a way you get to know them, to understand them.
Exactly. So he's very upset when bodies are just kind of left around. And then we're told that Digby wants to have a word alone with Mike.
Mm.
He's taken into some back room.
Yeah, they kind of con Jill and Jubal into like distracting them while they take him back into a back room with the leader of the church and close the door. And Jubal's really upset. He's like,
right.
oh, they got
And he
me.
Tries, he's like banging the door, like, how do we get him out? And then Mike emerges and Digby is gone.
I've been complaining about a lot. I really love this scene because I like how the other people, the flunkies, kind of go in there and they're like, oh, well, he must have gone out the back door, the secret door. And of course, as a reader, you're like, nope. No, that did not happen. He has been made to go away by Mike. And then Jubal knows it. And he's immediately like, well, we got to go. And he rushes them out of there. And then it's several pages later where it's revealed in an announcement by the church that that guy has been bodily assumed into heaven and there's a new guy in charge of the church. And I think Jill looks at Jubal at that point and says, do you think? And he's like, I don't even want to know. Let's not talk about it. We're just not going to even talk about it.
And it's at this point that Heinlein does his strangest move yet, which is we see the soul of Digby rise into heaven
yep.
alongside his
Foster,
who we're told he poisoned.
He poisoned him, yeah.
To get out
but
of the
it's
way.
But all is forgiven up in heaven.
But all is forgiven up in heaven. Foster is like, look, you know, you were a bastard, but then you were a good leader of the church, and you're not to do anything to interfere with or harm Mike, but you get to watch Mike here from our magical viewport that we have in heaven.
Our heavenly vantage point. I like the idea of the org charts for the afterlife here too, where it's like Mike is controlled by like the Martians. He says, and the implication here is that God is like the upper level, and then every planet gets their kind of own management system. So Mike is still kind of under the observation of the Martian old ones, who are the afterlife for Mars, and so you can't touch him, you can't do anything to him. And only later do they finally kind of have learned all they need to learn from Mike, and they let him go out of their protection. But I thought that was really kind of funny in the moment of being just kind of agog at the fact that, wait a second, right. Now it's just angels in heaven that we're dealing with here. Yep, mm-hmm. Angels in heaven. Heaven is real. There is an afterlife. When people discorporate, they go to heaven instead of hanging around and being old ones. Maybe that's why we are the way we are, I think the book is saying. It is a wild kind of thing. And then we find out, yeah, that these, like the one guy who just ascended to heaven poisoned his boss in order to get his job, but he still ascended to heaven. Well, it's all cool.
The thing about this sequence, the first time you come across it, I mean, first of all, you probably go back and reread a couple of paragraphs to make sure you are understanding what's happening.
Yeah.
It is amazingly difficult to suss out what exactly Heinlein is trying to do. I mean, it's hilarious. It's funny. And you're not exactly sure whether he wants you to take this all seriously insofar as even in the world of this wacky world, whether we're actually supposed to believe this is really literally what is happening, but it seems to be really literally what is happening.
Yeah.
And again, if there were more segments like this, I would not hesitate to call this book a masterpiece, but you had to wade through the last 300 pages to get here. And then I wonder, is it only as effective as it is because you had to wade through those last 300 pages?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say maybe not, but I can see the argument that you know you have to take the journey to get to this point, but it's a long way to go. Like it doesn't feel like this is the culmination of everything that's come before. It does feel like we've just been through so many of these episodes to get to this point.
Around this point, Mike changes drastically. He's been played as kind of a very naive. His speech patterns are oddly stilted, oddly Martian, and suddenly he kind of adopts the attitude of a huckster, of a cynic. He tells Jubal that he and Jill are going to go out into the world because they have to see the world. And when we pick up with them again, it's one of these sequences where point of view completely shifts and you're kind of disoriented for a moment because we're suddenly focusing on this person we've never met before. This woman, her name is what?
Patricia Powanski.
Patricia Powanski, who is a tattooed lady.
Pat. Yep.
In a traveling carnival. And
she's a Fosterite.
She's a Fosterite. And we spend a little time just kind of lighting on her. And then at the carnival she's in, she goes to see the act of this magician who sits around making things disappear and making his assistant float in the air. And we pretty quickly realize that this is Mike and Jill, mm-hmm. who have taken on these alter egos to go out and see the world. That's the best way to learn what life on Earth is like, is to go join a traveling carnival.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Which makes sense in the world of this book, I guess. Mike and Jill invite Patricia back to their room, and then there's an awkward and kind of gross sex scene between the three of them.
Yeah, so there's like a bathroom sex scene with Mike and Jill, and then Pat knocks on the door, and so they bring her in, and they're like, he's variously making clothes disappear. That's his thing that he does. It's like, that's his pickup line, I guess. And she has the tattoos all over her body, and they talk about that a little bit, and he thinks about tattoos and how he actually likes them because they make the person's body even more their own creation, which I thought was an interesting little aside that he did about tattoos. And then they talk about Fosterism, and they talk about belief, and then they make her his water brother. They all drink the water together. At which point he says, well, now that you've had the water, the next thing is that I have sex with you. And she says, okay. And that happens. And yeah, it's, and again, I have no judgments about this book is trying to say things about our hangups about things like monogamy versus polyamory, and that's all fine. It is kind of out of nowhere, I think, at this point, where it's like, oh, this is Mike now. Okay, Mike is now, after having been to the Fosterite church, Mike is now at the point where he's kind of behaving like a religious figure himself, right down to the, you know, you join my church, but I start having sex with you. And on one level, it's a free love kind of thing. On another level, it's like, is it a free love kind of thing, or is it a really weird power dynamic kind of thing? I don't know. But it certainly, in terms of the book, it's kind of like, whoa, what just happened? Again, left turn. We're now in a totally different place than we were before.
Eventually, Mike does set up his own little cult called the Church of All Worlds,
right?
Which he kind of takes bits of the Fosterite religion and adds some Martian ideas, and it basically becomes a sort of a hippie commune, mm-hmm. where lots of people show up. At this point, oh, by the way, we forgot to mention that Ben was eventually saved. Ben, as a character, is extremely important for the first 50 pages of the book, completely disappears, and then comes back here towards the end of the book. I mean, we are told that Jubal was able to broker Ben's release from captivity, where he was taken by the goons of the world government. But he shows up, and Ben has been pining for Jill because he loves Jill. But at this point, Jill is completely in the thrall of Mike.
Yeah.
And we have an odd sequence here where Ben goes to Jubal to talk to Jubal about having visited this nest, is what they call it, the home.
Right, because he's only an egg. Right. Right, is something that Mike always says. So he's visited the cult.
The cult. And in the cult, there are dozens of people at different levels of being in the circle or inner circle. Ben is told that he is actually in this higher level because he was one of the people that Mike knew before he knew anyone else on Earth. And so he's invited to become a member of the Church of All Worlds. And Jill and this other woman, Dawn, who you're told is a stripper who's joined the Church of All Worlds, offer to have sex with Ben, as does Mike, I guess. They're all going to have sex together. And Ben runs out of there,
yeah.
because his poor little square mind just can't deal with the truth bombs that Mike is... And so he goes back to Jubal, and then we have probably the most insufferable discussions of the book about the relative ethics of what Mike is doing. And we do have a clip here where
here it comes, folks.
So you can get a taste of what the writing is like at this point.
This poor ersatz Martian is saying that sex is a way to be happy. Sex should be a means of happiness. Ben, the worst thing about sex is that we use it to hurt each other. It ought never to hurt. It should bring happiness, or at least pleasure. The code says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. The result? Reluctant chastity, bitterness, blows, and sometimes murder, broken homes, and twisted children, and furtive little passes degrading to woman and man. Is this commandment ever obeyed? If a man swore on his own Bible that he refrained from coveting his neighbor's wife because the code forbade it, I would suspect either self-deception or subnormal sexuality. Any man virile enough to sire a child has coveted many women, whether he acts or not. Now comes Mike and says, well, there's no need to covet my wife. Love her. There's no limit to her love. We have everything to gain and nothing to lose but fear and guilt and hatred and jealousy. The proposition is incredible. So far as I recall, only pre-civilization Eskimos were this naive, and they were so isolated they were almost men from Mars themselves. But we gave them our virtues, and now they have chastity and adultery just like the rest of us.
Well, that I think that I've learned a lot by this.
Did he blow your mind?
It's all. I mean, that's the thing, is this is not. There's a lot of this. This is a good sample of what this is like, but this happens a lot. And in this section, you're right, where Ben goes back to Jubal, that Jubal's got, you know, he's got it all figured out, man. He's above it all because he's sort of not doing the sex thing anymore. But he gets it. He's a cool dude. I think this is roughly where that other stuff about, like, comparing women to cats. And saying that most of the time when a woman gets raped, it's partly her fault. I think that's all in here too. This is just a huge data dump of, like, Robert Heinlein's. I'm gonna say, you know, his view of human sexuality. It kind of comes out here. I don't think this is him inventing someone else's view, right? It certainly feels like the hand of the author is going to tell you a lot, and it's just. You know, today this would be message board posts somewhere, I feel like he just needed to get it out of his system, and he put it in a novel. But it's a very frustrating part of the book, this whole part.
Okay, so now we're going to get on to the final
Here we
part.
Go.
I called part 5 his happy destiny. I don't know if I've given all the parts. I don't care.
No.
but the book is divided up into these sections. And at the beginning of the section, we go back up to heaven where Foster and Digby are talking, and they say that Mike has been released by the Martians. And
yeah, the Martians, we see at some point that the Martians, I think it's right around here, the Martians have learned all that they need to learn from Mike. And that they had assumed. So part of the backstory here is that at some point in Martian history, there was a fifth planet between Mars and Jupiter that they blew up because the creatures that lived on it were wrong, and so they destroyed it. And they've assumed that they will probably have to do that to the Earth too. That the people on Earth were wrong, and they allowed Mike to go to Earth just to see, but they're probably going to blow it up anyway. And at this point, they sort of get back the information from him and think, well, maybe they won't, you know, maybe they won't need to, because Mike is because of his report and because of how he's changing humanity, they probably won't in fact blow up Earth after all. But they release Mike from his contract essentially at this point too, and so that telegram goes to heaven, and the angels standing in heaven are like, all right, we can take him out now.
I realize that we've gotten this far into this discussion without discussing grokking, which is the major contribution of this book to the English language.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is the Martian word grok is a verb which could variously mean to understand something, but it can also mean to love something and to hate something. The concept is basically that if you know something well enough to make it a part of you, so there is no longer any division between you and the object, then your communion with that other thing will become so total that you will not only understand it, but you will love it, you will hate it,
yes,
you will know everything about it, mm-hmm, and you will cherish it. And at the point that the Martians grok Earth, they may or may not destroy us.
Right.
It doesn't really matter, because loving and hating is kind of beside the point. They will know us, and they will know what to do with us. A lot is made of this in the book, because it's kind of made to be a concept that humans can't understand. And I find that immensely frustrating, because as it's explained in the book, I feel like I understand it pretty well.
Yep. Yeah, it was written by a human in a book for humans. I think it's explained very, very well. It is like the only real Martian word we get. The whole idea is that the Martian language sounds like a bunch of croaks, and so grok sounds like that too. But I guess at various points they are talking in Martian, and it's like, rah, 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 like that. It's just these croaking weird things that are happening. But yeah, I think it's a pretty. I mean, there's a reason that it got. It went into the language is because it is kind of an understandable concept. It is this knowing fully. It's not just I understand it, but it's like, no, I got it. I've completely got it. I know all the angles. And by Martian terms, it doesn't really mean this when people use it today, but by Martian terms in the book, it is, yeah, it's this complete understanding of something. You become it, and then you understand it completely. And I think that's a concept from philosophy and throughout human society. It's like, that's not an unreasonable concept. That's that understanding. It's like, to truly understand it, you must become it. And at that point, you know it, and then you can love it and hate it because you know everything about it. And that's what grokking is.
Yeah, it seems to me very close to certain precepts of Zen Buddhism, particularly the way that traditional Japanese brush painting is taught, the idea that you have to spend most of your time observing something, and then only after the experience of something is total, then the creation of the work of art is sort of beside the point almost.
Right. Right. The act of understanding it is the important part.
And in any case, we're told that the Martians have got all the information they need, and they're starting to think about having to destroy the Earth. Or maybe not.
I think they said there's a low percentage chance of destroying the Earth.
It's going to take them some time. But in any case, we're also told in heaven that Mike is going to be up for a martyrdom here. And so we're being telegraphed that this is the end of the book. What's happening on Earth is the Fosterites are getting upset with Mike because Mike has been going around. The other thing he's been telling everyone is thou art God,
right?
Which is the basic precept of this Martian-based religion.
God is in all of us, and to truly understand, I mean, it goes back to grokking. It's actually not that radical.
No.
a religious idea, but it is, I think, at the time, based on like sort of common Judeo-Christian, Middle American values, it's kind of shocking. And in this book, the Fosterites are so against it, also possibly because Mike may have assassinated their leader, that they like blow up his cult building at one point. But it's okay because they were going to get rid of it anyway, and he teleports everybody out into safety. But they're definitely, this is blasphemy. He's the enemy. This church is an enemy to Fosterism and is a threat, I think, because he keeps gaining followers. And so you mentioned
that Mike teleports everyone out. At this point, he's basically become like Dark Phoenix. He's Neo
in the Matrix.
Whatever power he needs to have for the plot at this point, he has that power.
You could kind of argue that maybe he always had all the powers all along, but at this point, we're not even accidentally learning. Oh, look, I can teleport things. He can do anything. He is the source code for reality.
Right, and so there is an angry mob approaching the hotel that he's staying in with his followers. I don't know where they are at this point. And Mike says, "Okay, this is it. This is where I'm gonna go show them a thing or two." And he goes out. His apotheosis is complete. He appears in flowing robes in front of them. He manipulates the very weather so that he can be bathed in sunlight, and he offers everyone water and says, "I'm bringing you the truth that you are God," and the crowd goes nuts. They start throwing rocks at him. Someone takes out a shotgun and blows off his arm, and he discorporates. So that's the end of Mike.
That's that. He looks at a grasshopper and says, "Thou art God," and dies.
So, but very happily, we're told, he dies, and his followers at this point, all of his followers at this point have completely drunk the Kool-Aid, and they are completely like little Mikes, and they're all like watching this on television. As this happens, it keeps cutting back and forth between this scene of mounting violence and these crazy commercials.
This scene of him, I don't know. On one level, I think it's kind of inevitable, and on another level, it's just like, okay, we get it. He's Jesus, basically, right? I mean, this is, I don't know. It is. We get that throughout, right? He is sent from another world, essentially, or he's Superman. One of those. They're pretty much the same, right? I think I learned that in Sunday school. Jesus, Superman. Anyway, you've got all of that going on here, and so yeah, I get it. I mean, it's almost obligatory in one way, and we've seen it before. And he's got to make the sacrifice. And I guess it is what it is. I guess I would have liked, I have lots of complaints about this book, but I kind of would have liked this to be a little less obligatory and more like meaningful in some way. And maybe that's the point here, is that it's not, it's like, this is what happens. This is what happens in cases like this, that there is a, you know, there is a martyr and he's stoned by a crowd and dies. And that's how it happens with these guys. I don't know.
No, I agree. This is completely very messianic and very, it feels very rote to me. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, again, I'm not sure at this point in the book how, whether we're supposed to be seeing Mike as this great guy or not, because his followers are all so weird at this point. There's this one point when Ben comes to the nest and he's talking to Jill, and Jill's introducing him to Dawn. She talks about the two of them and says, Mike has made us start to look like each other. And how, isn't that great, you know, that we now look like each other? And it's so creepy in a weird way.
Right, because everybody can change their appearance using their mind once you know the Martian kind of powers.
Right.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, think of it. I expect, this is actually maybe problematic in the book, but I expect that the idea here is that what they're creating is something that's different than Fosterism, but and maybe because it's more, well, the Fosterites believe it too, right? They're not frauds. It's not like they're not believers at the core of it, but that this is just another iteration of that. This is another seeking of truth, and he's got the truth based on the Martian, what the Martians have learned. So it's a new iteration of the church, but it's still just another one. And the fact that when Mike discorporates, he ends up even before that, the Fosterite guys are in heaven doing things, right? So the implication there is that this is part of, like, it's not like they go to hell or something. That this is part of how the universe works, is these churches. And so now Mike is also like the Fosterites. So on that level, if you view them as parallel in a way, then yeah, it is about maybe going too far or being strange. Is it? I can't decide either if they're challenging us and saying this is what it should be like, man, or if it really is just like, you should be challenged and think about it for yourself, about what you want and what you don't want. But you know, by placing them sort of in heaven running the show, there's also kind of an implication that it's all good. And again, I can't decide whether that is him entirely being satirical, because it kind of doesn't come off as that. I don't know.
Right before Mike gets killed, there's a sequence where he goes back briefly to the mansion, and we're kind of caught up with a bunch of people. There was a guy we never talked much about named Mahmood, who was the
Stinky.
Yeah, Stinky. He was a linguist who met Mike on Mars, and who's the only guy on Earth who kind of knows Martian languages. But it emerges in this discussion at the end of the book that Mike has been teaching his followers to speak Martian, and there's this implication that the church is just a front, and it's kind of not clear what it's a front for. That he thinks that it's that they're going to, he's going to bring people into having Martian powers, I guess is the idea. And I think the implication is he wants to inoculate the world against the Martian menace, you know, that is suddenly
right
there.
Which is in the text, because it's very clear, like, the Martians figure that they probably won't destroy the Earth. That would be the reason why. It's because they're making Earth more like Mars, so that Mars doesn't feel like it's a wrongness anymore, and that the chances of that succeeding are probably the chances of Mike's message. And Mike's message comes with powers, so there's that too, kind of spreading around the world.
In the very last chapter, they say that it would take them about 500 years to decide whether to destroy the Earth, but by that time, they probably wouldn't be able to. But just a couple little notes at the end. Jubal is the only one who isn't all okay with Mike's death, and he decides he wants to commit suicide. He goes to his room and takes some pills, and then Mike appears to him in a vision and helps him to go to the bathroom and throw up his pills. The next day, Mike's family gets together and eats him, or what's left of him.
Right, the bits that were left after the mob.
We're told they make kind of a broth out of him, and everyone drinks him down. And then in the very end, we go back up to heaven, where Foster has gotten reassigned somewhere, and Digby is introduced to his new boss, who just happens to be Mike.
It's like, yep, let's get to work.
Let's get to work. Now, Jason, what the hell was your teacher thinking? I mean,
I don't know. I think he was thinking, I think everybody read this. It's possible that this was on a reading list and you got to choose from 5 or 8 or something like that, and I chose it, but I think everybody read it. I don't know what he was thinking. It is shaking up the reading list is part of it, giving people other choices, like instead of the boring old books that everybody else had to read in high school. And you know, I think questioning assumptions in young minds, thinking about, I mean, that's the thing that I like about this book, maybe more in the abstract than in actually reading it, but this of challenging, like I said earlier, challenging culture and society and saying, no, you know, this isn't, things that we assume are natural order of things and the way humans are not. You are inside a system and you can step outside it and revisit things that you think are taboos. I think my English teacher, my young English teacher, was like, yeah, challenge authority, man. Let's get them all riled up and all of that. I can see that part of it, but as an adult and a parent reading it now, I'd be fine if my teenage daughter wanted to read this book. She wouldn't, but I would be fine with that because it's actually kind of delicate, despite the subject matter. It's not graphic. When people swear, it just says that he said a bad word, and then it continues with the dialogue. It doesn't actually use the bad word. It's kind of funny. And the sex scenes similarly are delicately handled. But I don't know what, I'll tell you, as a 15-year-old, 16-year-old person, I didn't get, like, what stuck with me was the Mike down in the bottom of the swimming pool and the cool, you know, the guy with the 3 secretaries at the swimming pool and the kind of wackiness of the mega church. But I don't know. I think ultimately it was about an assignment from somebody who this was a respected enough kind of work while also being a little bit edgy to be that cool teacher who could assign something that was different and new. And, you know, you're a new English teacher and you want to break some boundaries and shake things up a little bit from the you know, because
now this book does have a kind of an interesting literary history. It was, as we pointed out before, it was the first book that Heinlein published after changing publishers. He moved to Putnam to publish this, and it marked the beginning of his writing for an adult readership, and it became a bestseller, and it kind of took science fiction out of the ghetto it had been in, and So it's important in that way, but it's also, I would classify it in a group of novels that marked the baby boom era that were kind of big idea novels. And a lot of them today are kind of ridiculously flaky. Things like Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or things like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Mm-hmm. And these were books that this whole generation to heart in a weird way. I was having a conversation about this on the Facebook group for Sophomore Lit earlier, and I just don't get the feeling that people do that these days. I think that today we have things, people mentioned books like Eat, Pray, Love, but that has a kind of a qualitatively different feel to me. It has that's kind of more a personal memoir.
Right.
Or a book like The Secret, which is more of a kind of a self-help book that is kind of programmatic. you just don't see this kind of these kinds of weird, crazily ambitious books that. I mean, also the fact that all these books were adopted by sort of the counterculture.
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of it. And you know, this was a way that Robert Heinlein, I mean, I was joking when I said he should post it on a message board somewhere, but I feel like that was his way to get this stuff out there, was to put it in his books. And I feel like today, the way he wants to go about it in this book would not probably be stuffed inside a novel today. There would be some other, it would be on his blog or something, or in an ebook that he would write or something like that. It's a little bit different now that some of these ideas, it's not to say that you can't have political ideas in novels today, but this is so, there's so much of it here that it strikes me as that he might have gotten this out on the, you know, Heinlein's Thoughts blog and then not needed to explore it in this level of detail in his art. I don't know.
Well, I remember being confused by this book as a kid.
Yep.
And now that I've read it again, I feel like I understand it both more and less. I feel like I get what he was doing. I still don't quite understand why he was compelled to do it. And I'm glad to have read it. And I'm glad to say that I will never read this book again in my life.
Yeah, it was rough sledding for me too. I do feel like I understand it more as a 45-year-old adult than I did as a 15-year-old kid. You know, that scene where he kisses the girls really well. At least I can judge that now. I hadn't kissed a girl when I read this book the first time. At least I could roll my eyes at that a little and be like, whatever, dirty old man, whatever you say. But, at the time it was interesting to revisit it being, based on my memory of it. I think there's a lot of really cool stuff in here, but it is, as a whole, yeah, I feel it's too long and, you know, being 50 plus years old, it is, parts of it are really dated. But there's a lot of interesting, I kind of see what he was trying to do, but super frustrating, very long, and I, like you, I would be happy not to revisit this again. It was not, like, the pleasure we had when we read Vonnegut, when I read even the Asimov for the Incomparable episode, I did not extend to Stranger in a Strange Land. I don't need, and there's two versions. There's the long uncut version and the short version. I think we read the short version. Oh my God!
Thanks to Jason Snell for sacrificing his peace of mind to do this. You can hear his podcast, The Incomparable, on iTunes and on other shows on his Incomparable network. Thanks to Phil Gonzalez for his reading from the book. Look for his podcast, Deep in Bear Country, on iTunes. Thanks as always to Malcolm Nygaard for the theme song. His podcast is called Apoch Radio, and his website is Apoch Graffiti. Thank you, dear listener. You probably have a podcast as well. Join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook group if you like talking about books. And remember, everything will be on the final.